The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. Hi, everybody. This is Evan Mercer for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will read to you from the New Yorker magazine. I'll begin today with the weekend essay from the April 6, 2024 online edition of the New Yorker magazine, The Day Ram Dass Died. He taught me to be more curious, present, and self-loving. His final lesson was more surprising, by Christopher Fiorello. I woke up every 30 minutes the night before Ram Dass died, stretching my perception through the big divider that separated the study, where I lay on a narrow couch, from his bedroom. I'd count the seconds between the short, ragged breaths churning through his sleep apnea machine. 4 years later, I still have no idea why I was chosen to watch over him that night. I was at the bottom of the caregiver pecking order when it came to things directly related to Ram Dass's body. I lacked the size and strength to transfer him from bed to wheelchair or wheelchair to recliner on my own. Was too much of a novice to help organize his schedule or coordinate with his doctors, and was too unfamiliar to offer intellectual comfort in the rare moments that he wanted to talk. I'd met him 10 months earlier, had his voice in my head for just 3 years. There were people in the house, on Maui, who had known him for more than 3 decades. Before arriving, I had no formal medical training, but I had done 3 weeks of volunteering at a hospice facility in anticipation of coming to the island. Most of it involved moving Kleenex and changing the amount of light in empty rooms. Several times, I sat with the dying. It was overwhelming to look at their closed eyes, feeling the heaviness in the room, the sense of something happening or about to happen. I scanned their faces for signs of pain, of fear, or bliss, of transcendence. Through the palliative haze of opioids, they were impossible to read. No one was thrashing in pain. No one was smiling either. But it somehow buoyed me, being so close to death. The heaviness seemed critically important to my spiritual growth. I imagined myself giving peace to the dying through my presence, and in the process conquering my own fear of leaving life behind. During my time with Ram Dass, I flitted constantly between self-righteousness and self-pity, one day indulging in grandiose fantasy that I was the heir to his legacy, charged with scattering his ashes, and the next imagining that everyone in the house hated me. The caregivers called it the classroom or the fire, a site of purifying work, a pathway to enlightenment. My own work, purifying or otherwise, consisted mostly of handling various chores needed to keep a 6-bedroom cliffside home with a pool, guest house, and 2-acre yard going. For the bits that mattered, the scrubbing and the laundry and the cooking, there was a team of cleaners and a rotating cast of chefs. I ended up doing a lot of the rest, separating recycling, washing dishes, and replacing cat-scratched screens. There were 3 other caregivers in the house, and I was given a modest salary, plus my own room, meals, and shared access to a truck. I was an employee, but most days the house felt like a family, for better or worse. Still, this was only the 2nd time I'd been asked to spend the night in the study. It was generally perceived as an act of intense devotion, accepting a horrible night's sleep on a couch that reeked of cat pee, while facing the prospect of Ram Dass dying on your watch. I hated it, but I was there to care for the guy, however it was decided that he needed care. Most of the deciding was done by a woman affectionately dubbed Dasi Ma, a 70-something lapsed Catholic firecracker from Philadelphia. Dasi Ma was Ram Dass's primary caretaker, and though she no longer did the most strenuous physical tasks, she was still in command of what he got and when. often more so than Ram Dass himself. He was 88, and his health had been steadily deteriorating, owing to a host of issues, including chronic infections. When I moved to Maui to be near him in February 2019, he had almost died the night I arrived. He bounced back, to everyone's surprise but his own. "It wasn't time," I remember him saying in his stoic way, neither relieved nor disappointed. Now he had another spreading infection and what appeared to be a cracked rib from being transferred to and from his wheelchair. Ram Dass's life is the subject of multiple documentaries, an autobiography, and a docuseries in development starring High Maintenance's Ben Sinclair. He was born Richard Alpert in 1931 to a wealthy Boston family. His pedigree was sterling: a Stanford psychology PhD, tenure track at Harvard, visiting professorship at Berkeley. In 1963, after 5 years at Harvard, much of it spent studying psychedelics with his fellow psychologist Timothy Leary, he was fired for giving psilocybin mushrooms to an undergraduate. He bopped around for a few years, often taking obscene amounts of mind-altering substances with Leary at the Hudson Valley estate of his friend Peggy Hitchcock. In 1967, like so many other Westerners of the time, he traveled to India in pursuit of exotic answers to life's biggest questions. He'd grown disenchanted with the psychedelic world, which had come to seem rotely defined by highs and comedowns. In India, he met a Californian hippie named Kermit Riggs and followed him to a village called Kainchi in the Himalayan foothills to meet Riggs' guru. The guru was an old squat man named Neem Karoli Baba. Before long, an enthralled Alpert was reborn as Ram Dass, or roughly servant of God. He returned to America later that year, arriving at the airport dressed in white robes and with a long, scraggly beard, and began his career as a spiritual teacher. Most of what he talked about from 1967 to his death were the experiences he had with Neem Karoli Baba, whom he called Maharaji, Great King, and the spiritual beliefs that emerged from those experiences. One of his main ports of call became death and dying. In 1981, he co-founded the Dying Center in Santa Fe, an organization that described itself as the first place specifically created to support and guide its residents to a conscious death. The center sought, in effect, dying people who wanted to use their death to become spiritually enlightened, and staff members who wanted to use other people's deaths to achieve the same. Even before the Dying Center took shape, Ram Dass was lecturing on the spirituality of death, its place in the natural order, and the starkly contrasting way that he believed it was perceived in the East. His teachings were rooted in a specific vision of metaphysical reality, as informed by his guru and by the Bhagavad Gita, a sacred Hindu text. Roughly, he believed in non-dualism, that there existed an unchanging and absolute entity, the Hindu Brahman, which Ram Dass more frequently called God, the divine, or oneness, from which all material reality came. Included in that reality were souls, something like the Hindu Atman, which by their nature were caught in the illusion of their separateness from God, repeating a cycle of birth, suffering, death, and reincarnation until they remembered their true nature as part of the oneness, that is, until they became enlightened. Death could be a crucial moment for remembering this non-duality, as it was when the veil of separateness was thinnest. In his 1971 book, Be Here Now, which has sold more than 2 million copies worldwide, Ram Dass summarizes his views. "You are eternal. There is no fear of death because there is no death. It's just a transformation, an illusion." He often spoke to crowds afraid of dying, repeating that he had no fear of death. He sat with people on their deathbeds and talked routinely about the power of leaving the body. His efforts to quiet himself so that the dying could see where they were in the reincarnation process and do what they could do to escape it. His stories were sometimes graphic, people dying prematurely or dying in tremendous pain, but always tinged with a lightness and humor. Perhaps Ram Dass's most memorable remarks about death came not from his own mind, but from a woman named Pat Rodegast, who claimed she had channeled a spirit named Emmanuel from 1969 to her death in 2012. Rodegast was working as a secretary, raising children, and practicing transcendental meditation when she began to see a light, which evolved into what she called telepathic auditory guidance. Some of that guidance was captured in three books published in the 80s and 90s, two of which came with forewords from Ram Dass. According to Ram Dass, when he asked Emmanuel what to tell people about death, Emmanuel replied that it was absolutely safe, like taking off a tight shoe. I first encountered the voice of Ram Dass in 2016. I was 27 and living in New York, in a Chinatown building that rattled every time an empty box truck drove down First Avenue. Each morning, I tumbled down five flights of sticky stairs and placed one of his talks deep into my ears, letting his distinct blend of scientific erudition and spiritual mysticism carry me across town. He had a habit of segging from psychological concepts like attachment theory and childhood trauma to cryptic ones like Emmanuel's messages and the astral plane, pausing briefly to ask listeners if they could really, truly hear this. He seemed to build on the insights of others who had revolutionized end-of-life care in America, thinkers such as the psychiatrist Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, but also spoke in the New Age argot of Alan Watts. I gobbled it all up, feeling my spiritual life deepen exponentially by the day. His lectures made me more pro-social, more anti-capitalist, more curious, and decidedly more self-loving. This was my second rodeo with spirituality. Growing up, a rigid strain of Protestantism had been foisted on me like a chore. In Kansas City, Missouri, I was enveloped by an atmosphere of creationism, tent revivals, and anti-abortion screeds. I still recall standing on a busy street as a six-year-old and holding a sign that read, "Before I formed you in the womb, I knew you, God." The teachings of Ram Dass were nothing like that. They were straight out of the hippie movement and seemed to license a more liberal, self-directed search for meaning. As the grind and filth of Manhattan wore me down, Ram Dass's voice became a salve, a way to wake up to the illusion of our separateness. I turned to his work again and again to ease my loneliness when, walking down the street, droves of people moved around me like I was a light post, or to arrogantly tell my ex-girlfriend that we would always be together, even though I'd already dumped her. After a couple of years, I learned that I could actually meet Ram Dass for free by signing up for one of his heart-to-hearts, a one-on-one, hour-long Skype call he offered as a sort of public service. When my time came and the man appeared on screen, I was stunned into silence. I had thought of him as a spry, ethereal figure who existed only in decades-old recordings. This Ram Dass was very old and lived with fairly advanced aphasia, a side effect of a major stroke he'd had in 1997. His speech was slow. In our full hour, he said roughly 60 words, but not at all ponderous. I thought it gave him a mystical quality. There was no format to the session. Ram Dass just smiled his winning smile and listened. At one point, after I'd nervously overshared, he told me, "You take yourself pretty seriously." That struck me as profound, at least at the time. But what endured was more feeling than words. It seemed he had arrived at a place from which he could find genuine love for strangers like me. It didn't strike me as brand positioning or as a form of ego. I didn't think he loved me in the sense that he wanted to be close or even that he cared whether we got to know each other. I just believed he saw me as another soul and that, in his view, that made me worthy of kindness. By then, I was walking around New York trying desperately to feel connected to anything. I wanted what Ram Dass had, so I left the city, intending, among other things, to get him to show me how to have it. The friend I'd discovered Ram Dass with had already moved to Neem Karoli Baba's temple in Taos, New Mexico. I visited him for a fortnight of cooking group meals, wandering through the snowy high desert, and hobnobbing with Maharaji zealots, including one white teenager who insisted that he was the reincarnation of Krishna, one of Hinduism's most revered avatars. Like the young Krishna of lore, he would steal away from the temple pantry to eat pure butter until caught. Some of this evoked my childhood church, where kids compared how quickly they could transition into speaking in tongues or flex the depth of their personal relationship with Jesus while leading a collective prayer. But this was my first encounter with Neem Karoli Baba devotees. I figured followers would be a bit more mellow the farther I got from his temple. Toward the end of my stay, I met a longtime friend of Ram Dass. He saw that I was eager to do volunteer work, known as seva, Sanskrit for service. So when he learned of my intent to find Ram Dass on Maui, he offered to put in a good word to Dasi Ma. That recommendation made the seemingly impossible possible. People of all ages came to the island to be near Ram Dass. Some found their way into the group texts for arranging kirtan, living room chanting session at Ram Dass's house, or beach excursions. A few found opportunities to be useful around the house, or made friends with one of the live-in caregivers, enabling them to drop by every week or so. But to be offered to help care for Ram Dass, for pay, as a virtual nobody, was exceptionally rare. Upon arriving at the house, I found it shot through with the same quasi-religious fervor I had seen at the temple. I was quickly intercepted by another caregiver and taken to a lean-to in a nearby pasture so that I could silently meditate with prayer beads. It was incredibly humid, and I got annihilated by mosquitoes. I returned to the house to find a living room packed with people chanting, mostly the Hanuman Chalisa, a devotional hymn that features verses like, "With the luster of your vast sway, you are propitiated all over the universe." A collective effervescence filled the room, and I joined along, staring at hundreds of statuettes of religious figures while fighting back the sense that I was in church. After more than an hour of chanting, we milled about, greeting one another over chai and snacks. Attendees swapped stories of Maharaji's miracles, told me that my presence must be part of his plan, sat smiling at Ram Dass's feet, their hands over their hearts. During my year on Maui, Ram Dass's foundation led retreats at a local resort, where hundreds of people would gather for spiritual talks and chanting. Inevitably, someone at these events would look at me with confusion or pity when I told them my name was Christopher. "He hasn't given you a name yet?" the person would ask. Ram Dass often bestowed a Hindu name on people, Lakshman, Govinda, Hari, Devi. I was fine with Christopher. But there were other moments, informal and fleeting, when I witnessed the mixture of play and profundity that first drew me to Ram Dass. One autumn morning, two other caregivers and I were helping him get through his daily routine, brushing teeth and hair, putting on clothes and hearing aids, making the bed. When I turned on Doja Cat's Go to Town, a song I later learned was about cunnilingus, I cranked the volume and the four of us started dancing with illicit glee. One caregiver jumped on the bed, another swung from the divider between the bedroom and the study, and Ram Dass waved his one mobile hand with bright eyes and a rascally smile. Another day, I was alone with Ram Dass, helping him pick out a shirt. Though I spent nearly all my time in the house, I could count the hours we had been alone together on two hands, and most of them had involved food and drink or foot massages, ostensibly to relieve the pain that he felt from diabetic neuropathy. On this day, the house was recovering from Ram Dass having been denied psilocybin owing to his health. I felt sorry for him. The drug was, after all, the beginning of his spiritual journey more than five decades prior. I asked him if the house ever felt like a prison. A full minute of silence passed, with me standing over him in his walk-in closet. Eventually, he tapped his temple and said, "This is the prison." When morning broke on December 22, 2019, and Ram Dass was still alive, I allowed myself a moment of relief. Dasi Ma came up, looking short on sleep, and took his vitals. They were horrible. We snapped into action, trying to comfort Ram Dass until one of his doctors arrived. The infection had pooled fluid in his lungs, which made every breath a burden. Wet, rattling half-breaths were punctuated by coughs of bloody mucus. He looked wrecked, but still managed a weak smile when his Chinese medicine doctor told a joke at his bedside. At some point, Dasi Ma and the doctor began talking in the study. Other caregivers were on an oxygen tank and essentials supply run. I was on one side of Ram Dass's bed. On the other was his longtime co-author, Rameshwar Dass, a friend since Kainchi. Then Ram Dass started choking. It wasn't that different from any of the other horrible breaths he'd taken that morning, except that he just couldn't breathe it. When he realized this, he turned to me with a look that haunts me even now. Light eyes, wide as quarters, mouth open, lips a bit rounded. I immediately panicked, calling for Dasi Ma and trying to get his adjustable bed as upright as possible so that he could clear his throat. Then, when that didn't seem upright enough, I frantically tried to lug his torso up so his head could hang over his waist. Perhaps he could vomit his throat clear. 30 seconds had passed since he first lost his breath. Somewhere from near his feet, the doctor snapped at me, "You have to calm down." It jolted me into an awareness that Ram Dass was dying, right there. Perhaps it did the same for Dasi Ma, because she sprang for the study, returned with a large framed photo of Neem Karoli Baba, and commanded him to focus. "Ram Dass! Maharaji! Maharaji!" she said, placing the photo at the foot of the bed. She told him that she loved him and that he could go. I told him that I loved him. And then Ram Dass stopped trying to breathe. I was the only person to leave the room. Stumbling into the study, I picked up my phone, hands quivering, and sent word to the other caregivers. RD's dying imminently, like within the next couple of minutes. The wind was screaming outside. On Maui's north shore, it wasn't unusual for it to reach 30, 40 knots, rattling the windows and throwing palm fronds across the lawn. That day, it had blown from early in the morning under a tightly woven blanket of gray clouds. Sitting in the study, I watched it bend the trees, felt the violence of it, indiscriminate. Ram Dass believed that fear kept us from recognizing our interconnection to all things. Change generates fear. Fear generates contraction. Contraction generates prejudice, bigotry, and ultimately violence, he said. In his teachings, he often placed fear and love on opposing sides of the human experience. Fear was the byproduct of the ego. Love was the byproduct of the soul that remained pure in the moment, especially at the time of death. When we are fully present, Ram Dass wrote, there is no anticipatory fear or anxiety because we are just here and now, not in the future. And yet this binary is precisely what made watching him die so disorienting. I've no idea what Ram Dass felt in those final moments, what he could see or hear. I really don't even know if that was fear I saw in his eyes, though it certainly looked like it. Perhaps it was surprise or another sensation entirely, the rush of emptiness before a huge plunge into something tremendous. Whatever it was, its existence seemed largely absent from his teachings. There were times when he acknowledged the pain and coarse brutality of death. In his book, Still Here, published in 2000, he writes, dying is often not easy. The stopping of circulation and starving of the heart muscle, the inadequate transport of oxygen to tissues, the failure of organs. Where can we hope to stand in our own consciousness during such traumatic conditions in order to die with clarity and grace? Yet the emphasis he placed over decades of lectures on the importance of grace during death made so little space for terror, for how fear could coexist with presence and even with love. In the minutes after his passing, the chasm between how he died and how I thought he was supposed to die reminded me of the betrayal I'd felt when at 16 I flouted my mother's and pastor's admonitions and stopped asking God for protection, only to discover that a similar slew of terrible and wonderful things still happened to me. In the house, too, marching through 3 days of death rituals before Ram Dass's body was removed, I felt my spirituality slip its moorings. Late on the second night, his body lay on ice in his study, a rite he'd specifically requested, hoping that it would help those around him transcend their fear. I sat on the floor and peered up at his face through candlelight. His skin whitish, blue, and gaunt, his mouth slightly agape. I waited for grace, for him to speak reassuringly from some other plane of reality. Instead, I was taken back to our final moments together, where fear sutured me to each passing second. Not fear of the past or some uncertain future, but fear of the vast, strange intensity of what is. Next, from the April 14th, 2024 edition of the New Yorker magazine, The Truth Behind the Slouching Epidemic. From the onset of the 20th century, poor posture has been associated with poverty, bad health, and even civilizational decadence. But Does the Real Problem Lie Elsewhere? By Rebecca Mead. At the bottom right of my computer screen, just out of my direct line of vision, lurks an animated scold, a cartoon giraffe named Rafi. He is the playful icon of an app called Posture Pal, which works in concert with a wearer's AirPods to warn against slumping while sitting at a computer. So long as I kept my line of vision trained on this text, Rafi stays discreetly out of sight. The minute I rest my chin in my hand in concentration, however, let alone sneak a glance at the iPhone that lies tantalizingly close to my keyboard, a baleful Rafi pops up, eyes wide open, mouth downturned. Sit up straight. Rafi is actually less intrusive than the animated animal featured in another posture correction desktop app, Nikos. This one employs a computer's camera to determine whether the user is slouching or slumping. If she is, an icon of a cat's face pops up on her menu bar, accompanied by a surprisingly realistic meow. It's a peculiar choice for a posture admonition. Surely a meow could make a user look down at her ankles for a creature that wants feeding or petting, rather than stiffen her spine, eyes front. Then again, nobody would voluntarily install an icon of an angry drill sergeant on a personal computer. The association of animals with posture correction goes beyond an accident of digital cuteness. As Beth Linker explains in her book, Slouch, Posture Panic in Modern America, published by Princeton, a long history of anxiety about the proximity between human and bestial nature has played out in this area of social science. Linker, a historian of medicine at the University of Pennsylvania, argues that at the onset of the 20th century, the United States became gripped by what she characterizes as a poor posture epidemic, a widespread social contagion of slumping that could, it was feared, have deleterious effects not just upon individual health, but also upon the body politic. Sitting up straight would help remedy all kinds of failings, physical and moral. And Linker traces a history of this concern. From the exchanges of 19th century scientists who first identified the possible ancestral causes of contemporary back pain to the late 20th century popularity of the Alexander technique, Pilates, and Hatha yoga. The epidemic's expression may have evolved, but even today it has hardly abated. On Goop, the wellness emporium, you can buy a foam roller to combat sitting-induced constriction of the waist and a plastic dome on which to therapeutically rock your pelvis. Sultry TikTokers demonstrate how to strap oneself into a corset-like garment that pins back the shoulders, while buff YouTube influencers explain how to appear inches taller by unfurling a tech-bent spine. Linker makes no claim, she says, about the realness of the epidemic or the degree to which poor posture is debilitating. She's not saying that Rafi and the Nikos cat are wrong to harry me, or that your lower back doesn't hurt. Rather, she sees the past and present worries concerning posture as part of an enduring concern about so-called diseases of civilization. Grounded in a mythology of human ancestry that posits the hunter-gatherer as an ideal form from which we have fallen. The origins of posture science date to the latter half of the 19th century, when archaeologists and natural scientists were starting to theorize the evolutionary relationship between Homo sapiens and other primates. There was debate as to which came first, upright walking or higher cognition, with the dominant view being that the evolution of the human brain preceded the development of bipedalism. This theory centered a relatively sophisticated mind as the defining attribute of our species, and thus was consistent with ancient hierarchical taxonomies that place man, with his ability to reason, apart from and above the beasts. Some scientists wondered whether certain physical problems, like flat feet or scoliosis, were, in effect, the price of braininess. Linker cites the observation of a professor of anatomy at the Art Institute of Chicago. Man's original sin consisted in his getting on his hind legs. Before long, there was a societal investment in the betterment of health through the improvement of posture. Among the significant popularizers of posture science was Jesse Bancroft, who helped found the American Posture League in 1914. Linker offers a biographical sketch that sounds like the premise for an art house historical drama. Bancroft was a self-proclaimed invalid who grew up in a remote region of the upper Midwest, where she came under the tutelage of one Anna Janice Miller, an anti-corsetry reformer who held parlor classes on hygiene and recumbent exercises. Like her mentor, Bancroft became a lecturer on health culture, eventually moving to New York City, where she served as the first assistant director of physical education in the public school system. There, she introduced a standardized posture test that could be easily carried out by a teacher, equipped with little more than a pole against which a student's carriage might be compared. Students who failed the assessment, as much as 60% of the public school population, could be assigned corrective exercises. Bancroft and her posture peers were influenced by progressive education advocates, including G. Stanley Hall, William James, and John Dewey, who emphasized the importance of play and outdoor activity for children, but did not recommend militaristic drills and synchronized calisthenics, which were associated with old world European conformity rather than American individualism. On the other hand, the embrace of individualism held its own postural perils. Among the bugbears of early posture advocates was the debutante slouch, a fashionable stance associated with less restrictive garments in which the hips jut forward and the shoulders stoop. This way of standing was seen as an embodiment of high-class decadence. In The Great Gatsby, the first thing Nick Carraway notices about Jordan Baker is her failure to slouch. She has an erect carriage, which she accentuated by throwing her body backward at the shoulders like a young cadet. Though her posture is the only thing upright about her, she is also incurably dishonest. The dissemination of the debutante slouch through displays in department stores and drawings in mail order catalogs, both recent innovations that brought mass-produced fashion within reach of the middle class, amounted to a kind of social contagion in which the fashionable slouch threatened to become a commodity in itself, a cost-free way to climb the social ladder. In America, at the turn of the 20th century, anxieties about posture inevitably collided with anxieties not just about class, but also about race. Stooping was associated with poverty and with manual industrialized labor. The conditions of working-class immigrants from European countries who, in their physical debasement, were positioned well below the white Anglo-Saxon Protestant establishment. Linker argues that in this environment, posture served as a marker of social status, similar to skin color. At the same time, populations that had been colonized and enslaved were held up as posture paradigms for the elite to emulate. The American Posture League rewarded successful students with congratulatory pins that featured an image of an extremely upright Lenape man. The head-carrying customs associated with African women were also adopted as training exercises for white girls of privilege. Although Linker notes that Bancroft and her peers recommended that young ladies learn to balance not baskets and basins, which signified functionality, but piles of flat, slippery books, markers of their own access to leisure and education. For black Americans, posture was even more fraught. Despite the admiration granted to the posture of African women bearing loads atop their heads, community leaders like Dr. Algernon Jackson, who helped establish the National Negro Health Movement, criticized those black youth who too often slump along, stoop-shouldered, and walk with a careless, lazy sort of dragging gait. If slouching among privileged white Americans could indicate an enviable carelessness, it was seen as proof of indolence when adopted by the disadvantaged. This being America, posture panic was swiftly commercialized, with a range of products marketed to appeal to the 80% of the population whose carriage had been deemed inadequate by posture surveys. The footwear industry drafted orthopedic surgeons to consult on the design of shoes that would lessen foot and back pain without the stigma of corrective footwear. One brand, Trupedic, advertised itself as a real anatomical shoe without the freak show look. The indefatigable Jessie Bancroft trained her sights on children's clothing, endorsing a company that created a right posture jacket whose trim cut across the upper shoulders gave its schoolboy wearer little choice but to throw his shoulders back like Jordan Baker. Bancroft's American Posture League endorsed girdles and corsets for women. Similar garments were also adopted by men who, by the early 1950s, were purchasing abdominal bracers by the millions. It was in this era that what eventually proved to be the most contentious form of posture policing reached its height, when students entering college were required to submit to mandatory posture examinations, including the taking of nude or semi-nude photographs. For decades, incoming students had been evaluated for conditions such as scoliosis by means of a medical exam, which came to incorporate photography to create a visual record. Linker writes that for many male students, particularly those who had military training, undressing for the camera was no biggie. For female students, it was often a more disquieting undertaking. Sylvia Plath, who endured it in 1950, drew upon the experience in The Bell Jar, whose protagonist, Esther Greenwood, discovers that undressing for her boyfriend is as uncomfortably exposing as knowing that a picture of you stark naked, both full view and side view, is going into the college gym files. The practice of taking posture photographs was gradually abandoned by colleges, thanks in part to the rise of the women's movement, which gave co-eds a new language with which to express their discomfort. It might have been largely forgotten were it not for a 1995 article in the Times magazine, which raised the alarming possibility that there still existed stashes of nude photographs of famous former students of the Ivy League and the Seven Sisters, such as George H.W. Bush, Bob Woodward, Meryl Streep, and Hillary Clinton. Many of the photographs in question were taken and held not by the institutions themselves, but by the mid-century psychologist William Herbert Sheldon. Sheldon was best known for his later discredited theories of somatotypes, whereby he attributed personality characteristics to individuals based on whether their build was ectomorphic, endomorphic, or mesomorphic. By the time the Times article was published, Sheldon was dead, and his theories, which were found to have been shot through with racial stereotyping, were buried. Many thousands of his photographs of Ivy League students remained in the National Anthropological Archives at the Smithsonian's National Museum of Natural History, and, as the article observed, the danger of their ever being released or even the mere fact of their existence conferred on some of the most overprivileged people in the world the one status distinction it seemed they'd forever be denied, victim. The scandal prompted the archivist to shred thousands of Sheldon's images that had been held in the institution's own secure storerooms, in order to placate exactly the kind of high-status individuals who are used to getting their way. The result was the destruction of a large-scale historical record that might have been of incalculable use to current and future researchers. Linker cites as a parallel the Framingham Heart Study, which has been recording the cardiovascular health of residents of Framingham, Massachusetts, since 1948. As it turned out, the hasty bonfire of the nudities did not, in fact, consume all the images retained in the Sheldon archive, providing Linker's story with a nasty sting in the tale. Sheldon had also made photographs at institutions such as the Oregon State Prison and the New York State Hospital System, and those images, according to Linker, are still listed in the catalog as intact. Linker draws attention to an academic research project that was carried out in the 1970s. Gretchen Dyack, then a doctoral student at Yale, set out to use postural images taken at Smith College, cross-referenced with present-day self-reports by alumni, to see whether the presence of spinal curvature in a teenage girl predicted back pain in later life. Although, in Linker's telling, Dyack went to scrupulous lengths to protect the subject's anonymity, former Smith students were distressed to discover that the school still held the photographs, and it was ultimately obliged to destroy them. Before it did, though, Dyack was able to determine that, contrary to the decades-long drumbeat of the posture correction establishment a diagnosis of poor posture in youth didn't correlate strongly with future back pain. Even scoliosis, which at the time was aggressively treated with metal braces and sometimes with steel rod implants, played a relatively unimportant role in the development of spinal pain in the adult years. The findings brought into question all the allegedly predictive surveillance of posture, not to mention all the devices and treatments sold to Americans with the promise of averting future pain. Linker is scathing about the way in which additional research to confirm or develop such findings has been foreclosed by the photograph's destruction. The result, she worries, is that the dubious narrative that slouching is bad for you has hardened even further into conventional wisdom, stigmatizing bodies that may be less than perfectly upright, but are nonetheless pain-free, in a type of therapeutic reasoning that essentially makes the risk of disease or disability acquisition a disease state itself. Today, the descendants of Jesse Bancroft are figures like Esther Gockhale, a Bay Area acupuncturist and the creator of the Gockhale Method, which teaches primal posture courses to tech executives and whose recommendations are consonant with other fitness trends, such as barefoot running and paleo eating, that romanticize an ancestral past as a remedy for the ills of the present. The compulsory mass surveillance that ended when universities ceased the practice of posture photography has been replaced by voluntary individual surveillance, with the likes of Rafi the giraffe and the Nkosi cat monitoring a user's vulnerability to tech neck, a newly named complaint brought on by excessive use of the kind of devices profitably developed by those paleo-eating, barefoot-running, yoga-practicing executives. Meanwhile, Linker reports, paleoanthropologists quietly working in places other than TikTok have begun to revise the popular idea that our ancient ancestors did not get aches and pains in their backs. Analysis of fossilized spines has revealed degenerative changes suggesting that the first upright hominids to roam the earth likely experienced back pain or would have been predisposed to such a condition if they had lived long enough. Slouching, far from being a disease of civilization, then, seems to be something we've been prone to for as long as we have stood on our own two feet. And now from the comments section of the April 15th, 2024 issue of the New Yorker, Joe Biden and U.S. policy toward Israel. After 6 months of war, has Israel's killing of World Central Kitchen aid workers compelled the president to do more to save lives in Gaza? By Evan Osnos. The matter of moral sympathy, who attracts it, who gives it, what action it inspires, can be cruelly fickle. 6 months ago, Hamas militants killed some 1,200 people in Israel and took more than 200 hostages, igniting a war in Gaza, in which Israel has killed some 32,000 people. But it was Israel's fatal attack on 7 aid workers in Gaza, who were part of Jose Andres' World Central Kitchen, all but one of them non-Palestinians, including a dual U.S.-Canadian citizen, that compelled the Biden administration to issue its strongest rebuke. WCK had built a makeshift jetty to bring food ashore in Gaza, where hundreds of thousands faced the prospects of famine because Israel had resisted calls to allow more aid in by land. The 7 WCK workers were traveling in a convoy of 3 cars, at least one of which was clearly marked with the organization's logo, when they were hit by drone-fired missiles, even though the group had coordinated its mission with the Israel Defense Forces. The Israeli military called the strikes a tragedy and blamed them on a drone operator who mistook a bag for a gun and on officers who did not review details of the convoy's plans. 2 officers were dismissed and others were reprimanded. But WCK was unsatisfied. In a statement, it called for an independent investigation and for systemic change toward protecting the provision of humanitarian aid. Andre, a Spanish-born chef first known for creating popular restaurants in Washington, D.C., has put together an unusually high-profile relief group, which specializes in preparing local food for people in areas devastated by natural disasters and war. He is a supporter of President Biden, who called him on Tuesday to offer his sympathies. But later, in an interview with Reuters, Andres urged the administration to do more to end the war, saying that it is complicated to understand how the U.S. could send the military to do humanitarian work while the weapons it provides are killing civilians. The attack laid bare the untenable contradictions in Biden's policy toward Israel. He has called Israel's bombing campaign indiscriminate and said that an invasion of Rafah in southern Gaza would cross a red line. The administration has airdropped supplies into Gaza, even as it has furnished Israel with bombs, rockets, and other lethal aid, and pressed Congress to approve the sale of F-15 jets to the nation of Israel. In political terms, the contradictions have left Biden in no man's land, more critical of Israel than its American supporters want, but not critical enough for Democrats and activists who have demanded that he pressure the Israeli Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, to curb the suffering. What the people of Israel must understand, Senator Bernie Sanders, an important Biden ally, said last week, is that they cannot continue to wage this immoral war against innocent people and expect taxpayers of the United States to support them. By Thursday, Biden's frustrations had reached a breaking point. During a tense 30-minute telephone call with Netanyahu, according to the White House, the president said that an immediate ceasefire is essential, described the overall humanitarian situation and strikes on aid workers as unacceptable, and warned for the first time that U.S. policy will be determined by our assessment of Israel's immediate action to address those issues. The administration did not specify any consequences, but officials had signaled before the call that Biden might slow or halt shipments of categories of arms. Hours later, the Israeli government announced new routes for relief supplies into Gaza, but Secretary of State Antony Blinken said that the real test is results. Pressure on Netanyahu to reach a ceasefire has grown in Israel, too. Amos Harrell, the senior defense analyst at Haaretz, said that half a year after the horrors of October 7th, the biggest conclusion of all is we had the sympathy of the world because of the atrocities, and we somehow managed to lose that because of the way the war was handled. In recent months, Israelis have mostly refrained from protesting the government, but last weekend, tens of thousands of them staged the largest demonstration since the war began. Some later tried to break through barriers near Netanyahu's residence in Jerusalem in what police termed a riot. The protesters blamed Netanyahu for security failures that allowed the worst terrorist attack in the nation's history and demanded that he reach a ceasefire deal that could bring the hostages home. Officially, Israel counts 130 still held by Hamas, including at least 34 who have died. On Wednesday, Benny Gantz, a member of Netanyahu's war cabinet and his main rival, called for elections in September. Gantz stopped short of resigning, but he is an influential voice, and his decision, as one U.S. official put it, breaks the seal. For months, Biden sidestepped calls to place conditions on military aid. His resistance runs deep. He is viscerally attached to the idea of Israel, which he first visited in 1973, and withholding arms during a war could cost him the support of pro-Israel voters at a moment when he is straining to rebuild a political coalition broad enough to defeat Donald Trump in November. Moreover, Hamas has threatened to mount further attacks akin to October 7th until the state of Israel is destroyed. But Netanyahu has often seemed intent on stringing Biden along, if not humiliating him. Most recently, as Blinken and other senior officials have shuttled around the Middle East to negotiate possible deals for a ceasefire, Netanyahu's top intelligence chiefs have not attended some rounds of the talks, blunting the chance of an agreement. Whether Biden moves to withhold arms and with what force may well hinge on what Israel does in the days ahead. The president's ultimatum earned him few immediate political points. Israel's critics derided it as too little, too late. Israel's supporters accused him of abandonment. but it has the potential to alter the future of a war that could yet break in multiple directions. Washington's primary goal has been to avert the spread of a larger conflict, but that risk increased last week when Israeli planes bombed a building next to Iran's embassy in Damascus, killing 7 Iranian security officials, including high-ranking commanders, who Israel said had directed Hamas, Hezbollah, and other militias. Iran vowed retaliation. The combination of these issues converging at once was alarming, even by the standards of the Middle East. But Andres was not giving up hope that moral sympathy will win in what he has come to see as a war against humanity itself. In such a war, he said, humanity eventually will always prevail. And now a poem from the April 1st, 2024 issue of The New Yorker, The Hymn by Mary Howe. It began as an almost inaudible hum, low and long for the solar winds and far dim galaxies. A hymn growing louder for the moon and the sun, a song without words for the snow falling, for snow conceiving snow, conceiving rain, the rivers rushing without shame. The hum turning higher into a riff of ridges, peaks hard as consonants. Summits and praise for the rocky faults and crusts and crevices, then down, down to the roots and rocks and burrows, the lake's skittery surfaces, wells, oceans, breaking waves, the salt deep, the warm bodies moving within it, the cold deep, the deep underneath gleaming, some of us rising as the planet turned into dawn, some lying down as it turned into dark. As each of us rested, another woke, standing among the cast-off cartons and automobiles. We left the factories and stood in the parking lots, left the subways and stood on the sidewalks, in the bright offices, in cluttered yards, in the farmed fields, in the mud of the shanty towns, breaking into harmonies we'd not known possible, finding the chords as we found our true place, singing in a million, million keys, the human hymn of praise for every something else there is and ever was and will be, the song growing louder and rising. Listen, I too believed it was a dream. We've run out of time for today's episode of The New Yorker. I hope you enjoyed it, and we'll be sure and listen next time. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. The New Yorker readings are available as podcasts at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service today. This is Evan Mercer. So long, everybody.